I'm very happy to be talking to Mario Robinson today in New Jersey. Mario is an American artist, and he's been named by the Artist magazine as one of the top 20 realist artists under the age of 40. He's also on my list of living masters working today. So, hello, Mario. It's very nice to be talking to you.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me on. This is great.
You're very welcome. Okay, well, this is the question I start off with now, it seems to be, for all artists. So why do you think that art exists, Mario?
I think art exists for a myriad of reasons. I think in the contemporary sense, it's become more convoluted, but I think when you go back into history, you know, before cameras and video and all of that, I think it was just an absolute need to understand and maybe even record the environments. And it also became propaganda for other cultures. Right. You know, so I think for me, I'll speak for myself. I don't know why it exists, but I'm glad it does, because for me, it's a meditative kind of experience, a way to reconcile the world that I'm living in, almost holding up a mirror to nature and the people around me and kind of communicating that to the broader world and kind of making sense of my lived experience.
Right. So when you say holding up a mirror, you mean like the surface of the painting is like a mirror, or is it an internal mirror, or?
I would say it's a figurative mirror, you know, okay. Because you and I can look at the same thing and see something totally different. But if I hold a mirror up based on the work that I'm creating, it can kind of make you see something or even a person different. It can be more empathy. It could be with more beauty. You know, when people look at my work, it's not a stereotypical type of beauty. So if we're talking about one of my portraits versus another artist's portraits where it's a pretty girl propped up on a couch nude, and I'm doing an older person, maybe it could be an elder, you can almost see more beauty in what I'm doing based on, you know, how I do it than the idealized version of beauty that another artist would would paint.
So it's kind of the reflective aspect of a mirror, like it's a reflection of how you say things.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lovely. So who are your kind of creative heroes?
I kind of look toward the American masters for my inspiration. I think it's no secret if people have followed my work, know that I'm a big fan of Andrew Wyeth, not only as an artist, but as a storyteller. Winslow Homer is another hero of mine, and Thomas Aikens. And I try not to look too far in the past for inspiration, because they lived in such a different culture. You know, I don't wear elaborate outfits, dinner parties and things like that. I grew up in a very different, very different time, different culture. And I try to, you know, just like I said earlier, just show the time in which I'm living, and I can identify more with someone who lived, you know, a few decades before myself, and not, you know, far reaching into the past. Although the paintings are very beautiful and I'm inspired by them, I just don't take a lot of my cues from them.
Right. And are all your creative heroes artists?
Oh, no. One of my earliest creative forces was my mom. My mom, she actually used to make jeans at this warehouse. I think they might have been Jordache. And it was a place called Kelwood in Oklahoma. And that passion spilled over to her private life, and she would make us, you know, suits, and she would make my sister's dresses, and I would even help her cut patterns on the floor. Right. And I would just see her just throw herself into it, and she was more calm and relaxed when she did it. And I didn't have anything like that for myself as a child, and I just looked at it and said that there must be something, you know, to her being creative, right, that settles her.
Okay, so you were kind of a child prodigy, really, in a strange kind of way. You were talking about that observing creativity, because you kind of did that in school as well, like observing other kids who could draw. Mm-hmm. But you didn't actually do any drawing until you started drawing, you know what I mean? Because then you're asked, like, or the class is asked to paint these presidents, and then suddenly, mm-hmm, you know, everyone's painting in pen, and you pick up your pencil, and by the looks of it, you haven't put it down since. You've just been, like, full steam going.
Even when you want to, on this level, you can't.
So then you did a couple of other things, right, and which we'll come back to in a minute. Then you went to art college in New York. Then a couple, mm-hmm, of years after that, you finished art college, and you're living in Alabama with your mother, and then, mm-hmm, you start to paint these local people there. Now, from the outside, looking at, you know, your kind of work, it looks like that's the point that you really started to come into your own as an artist. Is that right? Like, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you encapsulated it. You're right on top of it. You know, when I graduated art school in 94, my mother was being transferred to, she was a civilian in the army, and she was being transferred to a base in Alabama. And I said, I'll move with you and try to help you get settled. She had never been there. And I had never gotten my own model. I had never, before that, I was drawing and painting in art school and, you know, in art studios, and even drawing for magazines on my own time. And I'd never, you know, gotten my own model until I got to Alabama. And I just immersed myself in that culture. It reminded me a lot of Oklahoma, where I grew up.
Right.
And I just got inspired. And
so what was it about those people, do you think, that really spoke to you?
Well, after being in New York for so long, and even New Jersey, at art school and just being in a faster pace, there was something longing that I hadn't really fully reconciled as an adult, you know, because the slower pace of my small town in Oklahoma, you know, kind of, I had to shed that, you know, when I came up to the East Coast. And I think going back to Alabama and seeing those people, you know, my first model that I got down there, she would wear dresses to school, and that was kind of what I'd seen growing up, you know, with my, yeah, sisters and other people. So it was like a throwback. It was surreal almost, you know, seeing, you know, a culture that was still that slow in the 90s. So it wasn't even, it was just a knee jerk reaction of, I have to paint these people.
Right. It sounds like returning to your childhood as an adult almost.
Yeah, and as the series progressed and as I did more of them, I was able to find almost characters to replace my grandmother, my grandfather, and a lot of the images are almost replicas of the people that I had left in Oklahoma.
Right.
And it was heavy. You know, it was, and for a young person in my 20s to be doing that, early 20s, it wasn't willful. It was just, this is what I'm surrounded by. This is what I'm inspired by. And it just took on another life as I got different models, and I wasn't even aware of what I was doing, but it became very, very inspiring.
Mm. When you say it was heavy, what do you mean?
You know, a lot of people my age, you know, they weren't tapping into a lot of their emotions. A lot of people were still getting models, you know, going to open studios or, you know, focusing on themes that were a little more light. And I think I was at a place in my life, you know, during that period, I met my dad for the first time, and I was more about my personal journey and reconciling a lot of things within myself that had nothing really even to do with my art, but yeah, I was able to fuel my art with more of my personal story. And I think a lot of art really comes from pain and brokenness. And that's where you get the best art, because those are your most honest moments. You know, when everything is light and happy and, you know, it's a party atmosphere, you know, you don't really get a lot of truth. And I think that as a young person, delving into those things as my first series and just my first paintings, you know, it kind of guided me, you know, to where I am now, because I don't really want to do, you know, very light, you know, things that don't really touch people.
Right. Okay. And you've continued on with painting people. Have you, like, I don't want to sort of, sometimes you can overthink things, but have you figured out, like, what it is that you're drawn to, like, about people? Like, why you keep returning to it?
I like the complexity. I like the different moods of people. People are not only complex as far as anatomy and the outside things that we can actually see, but you can be working with a model and they'll start off in one mood, and then by the end of the working day or even a couple hours later, you know, their mood can actually shift and change, and you have to be open to that. And a static, like a still life, or inanimate object, it just doesn't give me that challenge. And like I said earlier, I'm always trying to reconcile, you know, what it is to be human. What is it about, you know, our humanity? What is it that makes one person love and another person hate? Right. And I can only get that through a portrait. I know what a human goes through. I don't know what a banana goes through, you know. So I can only get as deep as the exterior of an object. So with a person, I can go deeper, and I can even pour my own emotions into that empty vessel, right, you know, if I choose. So I can make it about the person that I'm painting, or I can make it about myself. There's a lot of hidden meaning in my work also. So, and then the professional part of it kind of guided a lot of the portraits that I was creating years ago, because the galleries, dealing with galleries, you know, they have the kind of model, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I like to paint seascapes. I live a few blocks from the ocean, and, you know, and I would show them and present them. And, you know, it's when you see these, you know, portraits and, you know, the seriousness of some of them, and then you show an ocean, yeah, they think, yeah, you know, come on, come on. And it's really interesting, because some artists are able to do that because they're really good at, you know, a pastoral landscape or, you know, a beautiful scene, and that's their thing. And then they want to do a portrait and it just doesn't hit. Right. So I think you just fall into what it is that you're supposed to do. And I don't want to be a one trick pony. You know, I have a book coming out in April, and it does have seascapes and other things. And it is called Lessons in the Classical Tradition. You know, it's a watercolor book, but we also have a subtitle of, you know, painting people in places. Right. So I don't want to just get stereotyped as the, you know, the portrait guy.
Yeah, yeah. So going back to the, you know, your, how you feel when you're working as well, what's the most moving picture you've made?
Oh, that's a good one. Most moving. For me, it's a watercolor of my mom that I painted in 2009. She, I painted it right before she had an aneurysm. And there were a few things I wanted to tweak. And I was just in the middle of doing that when she had the aneurysm. And it, going back to it after she healed up and everything, it took so many emotions to finish this thing. It was just a small 14 by 20 watercolor, but that's the moment that hit me. You know, because up until then, I was just painting family members and friends, and, you know, it was personal, but there was still another gear. There was still another level that I hadn't really tapped into. Almost like when Andrew Wyeth talks about the paintings he was painting before his father was killed in a train accident along with his nephew. You know, there's a tectonic shift sometimes in your life that shows you that other dimension. And this painting is a simple painting. It was just an impromptu moment where we were sitting on the porch at our house in Alabama. I said, "Ma, I never painted you. Let's do something. Go get a hat." And, cause you know, I like hats and, props. And she just had a light blue, top with her arms out, and she put the hat on and she looked away, and I went for it, but I didn't totally finish it. And then she had the accident, and I went back and finished it. And I, to this day, it's hard for me to even look at that painting because it kind of marks that time of vulnerability, you know? So, and there are other paintings, you know, I think the painting, the merit in some of them are, you know, more monumental and, you know, I spent more time on, but for me, it's all about emotion.
Yeah. And is that picture of your mom on your website?
No, I could send you an image of it though, if you like.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that'd be great. I'll put it in.
Okay.
I think after hearing you talk about it, I think people would like to see it. And, okay. But your mom got better after the aneurysm.
She did. Yes. She did. Thank you. Yes. She spent about 4 months in the ICU, and you know, they removed the aneurysm and everything. Her short-term memory is better than her long-term memory. I tease her a lot, and I say I'm jealous because there's some people in my past that I like to forget. You actually can do it.
But, back when you finished high school, and I think you'd already been accepted into Pratt Institute, the art college, you went to your mom and you talked to her about going to art college, and she had the talk in inverted commas with you, where she said something along the lines of, you know, this art thing, I don't really see it. I think you need to have something to fall back on. You know, I can totally relate to that. I had the exact same conversation. That's how I ended up being a carpenter when I left school.
Really?
So, but you didn't. You went into the army, which is a kind of an interesting direction for an artist to go in. What did you specialize in the army?
I was a weapons specialist.
Oh, okay.
And at that time, yes, it was before Desert Storm, but everybody was, you know, bracing.
Yeah.
You know, with the whole Cold War thing and everything, but I enjoyed it.
So your fallback is weapons.
Yeah.
So if this art thing doesn't work out, anyone's listening, the art thing doesn't work out for Mario. If you're looking for any guns or any, you know, any weapons expertise,
well, I don't have them stored up, but I can guide you. You know, it's funny because a lot of people, when they look at me now, I'm very thin and, you know, not the most, you know, muscular person coming at you, and they're like, "I can't believe you were in the army," but that's not what the army. I think that's the television version of the army. It's more about discipline, and I think a lot of artists are just as disciplined, you know, in their daily lives, and you kind of have to be. You know, there's the whole fighting thing, and but you're not doing that, you know, the whole time you're in the army.
No, oh, I don't know. I'll take your word for it. I imagine after you get over all the training stuff, it's pretty just routine.
Yeah, it was like a job. It was like an 8-hour job, just like anything else, especially during that time of, I guess I can say, peace compared to now.
Yeah. So you would have been like, you got out just before Desert Storm then, did you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
And so the talk that your mom had with you, did you have the other end of that conversation where she kind of, you know, after you'd become successful as an artist, where she kind of acknowledged you and kind of went, "Well, okay, it's worked out"?
You know, like, I'll use this analogy, John. There are two types of, like, football players or athletes. The type that score the touchdown and just hand the the football to the referee and go back to the sideline, or there's the more flamboyant one that spikes it and then does an elaborate dance in the end zone. I'm talking about American football. Yes. I'm more of a just hand the ball to the referee and just go about my business. I've never, had a conversation about it. I've never said, hey, look at me now. It's just a way of life because I had confidence in myself that, you know, I was going to land on my feet and I was going to do what I was born to do. And, you know, she was just being a mom, and she was just like a lot of parents in the world. They're protective over their children and their future. And I think she didn't want me living in her basement for like ever also. So it was partly selfish on her part too. But I think now, you know, she'll call me from, you know, bookstores and, you know, trying to find this particular magazine you're in, and she'll show it that way. But
right.
I think the work and the way I've lived my life has spoken for itself, thankfully. So I don't have to say, hey, you were wrong, I was right. You know, I just don't want to do that.
Oh, no. I mean, it's understandable. I mean, like, the chances of failure are much higher in art than success.
Oh, sure. And it is, you know, it is, it's gratifying. I'm not going to say it's not, because I could have totally gone the safe route and followed all of her instruction and ended up in a cubicle and miserable and, you know, all of that. So, you know,
a cubicle full of weapons.
A bunker, maybe.
A bunker.
So it's, in that respect, I, you know, it is deeply gratifying to live your life, you know, in a way that pleases you and gives you joy and hopefully brings joy to others, you know, because it could have gone the other way.
Yeah, yeah. So what's the biggest challenge you're facing at the moment as an artist, apart from time?
Oh, thanks, because that was obviously, I'm sure everybody's...
Everybody says time, default. Yeah. I think it dawned on me the other day that actually time is just something that everyone is dealing with. It's nothing to do with being an artist.
And then if we get more time, then we fill it with more activities. And you know, so I like to just maximize the time and space that I'm living in and dwelling in. So... yeah, I would like to have more time, but the challenge for me is just fighting off distraction and the whole thing that surrounds an artist, surrounds a person that's a little more recognizable. So I just try to fight that off and just not look at it, not feed into it, and you know, kind of guard my creativity and my thoughts, because I remember going back to, you know, the time when I was in Alabama, or, you know, earlier in my career when there were no cell phones, there was no internet. You know, your phone actually have to ring at the house and
yeah,
you get your actual
that.
News. You have to turn on a particular channel to get news. Now it pops up on your devices. You know, it's constantly chirping and chiming. So you just have to raise your level of concentration, to meet that. So that's the biggest challenge. Because if you're led too far, you know, in that direction, you won't have time to sit with your thoughts, and you'll start repeating, you know, themes and concepts in your work, and it won't be fresh anymore because you're so distracted that, you know, the work part of it'll become more tactile, and as long as your hand's moving, you'll think, wow, this is a good painting. But you really have to marinate those ideas and spend time, you know, thinking about what you really want to say, what you want to paint. So that's what I've worked on. It can be exhausting too, because I do have to spend so much time doing that, but it's worth it, you know, to just fight off those distractions.
So it sounds like one of the pitfalls of success is that it can push you into a kind of an autopilot. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. You can become robotic if you're not careful. You know, you can almost just go through the motions, and your mind, at least I'll speak for myself, my mind has to go over an idea before I know it's a good idea. I have to just go through it and just sit with it, and I can't have a lot of different things pulling what I'm just. I think Edward Hopper said it the best. He said, "A great painting is the gestation of the mind." You know, just getting that thought and just going over it obsessively, over it. You know, and I think that's it's a gift and a curse, because you don't want to just be an obscure artist that can't pay your bills and feed yourself. You know, then you have all the time in the world to think of great ideas, but you have no audience. So it's never going to be a perfect solution, you know, a perfect world.
Yeah. I used to do a bit of script writing, and I have a scriptwriter friend, and he was saying pretty much the same thing. Like he said, most of my day is spent on the couch looking at the ceiling and then just thinking it through. And then the writing bit doesn't take that long. People looking at me don't think I'm doing anything.
Yeah, it'll flow. Right, yeah. They say Albert Einstein used to just sit for hours and stare at a wall.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's another thing you have to be careful about is, you know, really caring too much about what people think. Because a lot of people, they even think that this is just a pointless pursuit. So, God forbid, they walk by you and you just, you know, tapping your head with a pencil and just like, no, this is fruitful. This is productive thinking. So you have to watch who you're surrounded with, and living with also. So, you know, that's also another part of it, is just really giving yourself over to being an artist and everything that it comes with, all the baggage, all of the, you know, the bad stuff that society can put on you.
Yeah. When you were back in, I think it was when you were in art college, you painted this portrait of Spike Lee on spec, which you gave to him, and he liked it and he asked you for another. How many portraits of him did you end up making?
Well, I wisened up after the second one, thankfully, but it probably would have been 100 if he had his way. That's just part of paying dues. And, you know, after that, I never did a commission. I still haven't done one. I did one small watercolor for a guy that used to work in the Bush White House. And it was comfortable because it was his grandmother that raised him. And she had a church hat on and, you know, just a small little 9x12. But I haven't really done a commission, probably because of that.
Because of Spike Lee.
It just burned me, you know. And I was
did he pay for the second one, or I know he didn't pay for the first one.
No, there was no changing of money, you know. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, they talk about celebrities and, you know, commissions and someone famous collecting their art, and they don't want to pay for anything. They have such entitlement issues. I don't want to be hooked up with celebrities. I don't want that word to get out. I don't, it's I might be the only one saying this, but I don't want that.
No,
problem,
no. Michael Folkrode was on the podcast last week, and he said he's in Hollywood. He actually works in Hollywood, knows loads of celebrities. And he was saying, that's the thing about celebrities. They just don't expect to pay for anything.
No, from what they're eating to what they're wearing to what they're decorating their house with, they just don't. And it's a good problem to have, but I just don't want to be a part of it. You know, I saw that very early on, how a person of fame or access can look at a student and say, why should I pay for this? I want another one.
Right.
You know, I'm doing something for you. You know, you can maybe put this on your bio or something. And I just had a different view of him and celebrity and everything after that. And it took me a while to get there, but at the time it was so euphoric.
Because prior to that, I think you sort of felt you had your sort of face pressed against the glass of that kind of world, and you were fascinated
literally.
By it.
Literally, because his office was only about 3 or 4 blocks from Pratt. So, you know, to get to the downtown area, you would have to pass it, and there would always be something going on. I remember when he filmed, he made More Better Blues, one of his movies back then. I remember Denzel Washington being in the area, and he was building these huge like apartments on one of the streets for a set, and the actors were always asking us for directions and
right.
and stuff like that. So it was always like that world was so enticing. You know, we would just go and just hang out, you know, near there. A couple of my friends had paintings in the movies and on the set. So they were just creeping around the campus getting art and stuff like that, you know. Yeah. So it was a lesson learned, you know. It wouldn't happen now.
No,
for sure.
So you haven't painted any other celebrities or anything like that since?
No. And I'm kind of the anti-celebrity kind of painter. I just have such an affinity for people that get up in the morning, you know, begrudgingly go and are subjugated to either a boss or a system and are still able to press through and have jovial moments, raise a family, you know. And some people don't even complain about it. They just think that this is how their life is supposed to be. And I love elevating that. I love showing that because I think that's what not only our great country of America is about, I think that's what the world is about. Those are the people that really keep this thing going so we can have celebrities and other people entertaining us while we're getting through our lives. We can't build this world on entertainment. You know, someone has to go to work and sustain this. And I think that's why my work is still, I think, being appreciated by different generations, because everyone has a grandmom, everybody has a mom, everybody has a father, a grandfather, and those family ties.
Yeah, well, in my, like, you know, as I said at the beginning, that I have you in the list of living masters, and in my little thing that I wrote about, I likened you to Van Gogh for that reason, in that he just saw something in very ordinary people, something really beautiful, just like you've described, and that's worth kind of focusing on.
Oh, thank you. I read that, and I actually brought a smile to my face, because that is what I like about Van Gogh. You know, there are better technicians. There are people that were more academic in their approach, but there's something in his work that's honest, that's real.
Yeah.
And I think that people look beyond the way he's saying it and really listening to what he's saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Lovely. So what advice would you give to a young aspiring artist?
Other than do not paint celebrities because they're not going to paint for it.
Definitely not Spike Lee.
Yeah, Spike Lee has to be off the list. But that's kind of an entree into what I want to say. You know, learn the value of your own creativity and what you're bringing to the world. You know, the world can have such an ostracizing effect on creative people. You know, they can kind of make you out to be weird, or, you know, the world doesn't need another drawing or painting. You know, when you're going to get a real job, and just fight off a lot of that dark thinking, and have confidence in yourself and even your peers, because it's real and it's serious. And if you commit to it, it can actually give you a life. And you might not be a millionaire, but you can have more joy and peace than a millionaire could ever dream of. So just stick to your guns if that is your true passion. If right. that's not your true passion, and you're just doing it because, you know, you want to be in vogue, or you want to be cool, or you want to be accepted, then go out and find your passion, whatever it is, even if it's a 9-to-5 job, because it can be tough, you know, being a young person, you know, and figuring it all out. But if you're serious about art and, you know, you do have the requisite skills to get through life, and you have to be honest, about your skill set as well and your ability to market yourself and focus. Go for it. I would say just don't give up.
And do you think there's a kind of a general time frame for a young, artist, say in art college, for when they could expect to start to find their own voice? Because there seems to be a lot of pressure on them at that very early age of like, oh, you really need to know what you're doing. Whereas, speaking to more kind of experienced artists like yourself, they're generally going, God, when you come out of art college, you haven't got a clue. How could you have a clue about anything? It takes years to actually really hit your groove. Yeah. For what you have to say individually. Is that right?
Yeah, and I don't envy them because there's so much competition, and there was competition when I was coming out, but it wasn't in my face like it is every day on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, and they're exposed to so much competition. I would say take as much time as you need. If you can figure out that other part of your life. I was talking to a young artist from California a few days ago, and he was asking for advice, and he was doing commissions that weren't leading anywhere, not really paying him, and then considering a full-time job, and I knew he was not going to have the energy to want to paint after working. He just finished up art school, so that's a trap. You have to avoid those traps when you first get out, because earning a living is right there in your face. Yeah. So I would say spend time figuring out that part of life, because that's going to facilitate the amount of time that you can actually commit to art. That was one of the first things that I did. I slept on, my friend's, I can't even say it was a couch, floor. And used to, I wish it was that generous. I think it wasn't that elaborate until his brother moved out and went to UConn. He went to college, and then I kind of inherited part of his little room until his parents were like, "Okay, we got a squatter here. You gotta move on." But he had a drafting table, and we were good friends, and I used it, and it lasted for about a year. We worked together till I quit the job and became a full-time artist for good. But my point is, he was kind of like a liaison between, the real world and kind of like me wanting to still be an artist. I wouldn't have been able to have my own apartment. I couldn't afford it. Yeah. So I would say just figure out that part. Yeah. And kind of, I'm not going to say mooch off your friends. I'm not going to make it literal. But I would say, there is a period where you have to try, you have to go for it, and really commit to trying to be an artist, because it's kind of late once you're, in a serious relationship. A person might want babies. The real adult stuff really kicks in. So. You have to really go for it and really be just crazy about it right out of art school.
Right.
And
when, like a couple of years or 3, 4, 5 years, out of art college, then you should be kind of thinking, okay, I should have found my voice by now.
I think it's different for everyone. I think you should really find your voice. You should kind of have your voice upon graduating. I don't know what you're doing at college other than just turning in, assignments and everything else. But while you're in college, life is still happening. Parents are still there. Grandparents are still there. Friends are still there. You're going to functions. You're inspired by life. And you should, those wheels should be turning when you're in that classroom. It shouldn't just be all about assignments.
Right.
If it is just about that, then you're cheating yourself, because you can, when I looked at, this is diverting, but I was visiting my brother-in-law in Italy, and we went to Urbino where Raphael was born, and they had at his house that he grew up in, his father, wasn't illustrated, but he helped him paint when he was younger. There was a portrait that he did at 12 years old that looks like the best thing that you might want to see in the Vatican.
Yeah.
At 12.
Yeah.
So you know, and I know we're living in a different time, a different culture, but if a person is telling me they're serious about something, you know, it's never too early to start really being an individual about, you know, your path, and not saying, well, this person said I should do 5 years. This person said I should have my voice in 7 years. Just really be dogged about what you're pursuing.
Yeah. Well, I suspect it's one of those things that you see it in hindsight. Like, you can look back and go, yeah, I didn't really get my groove till I was at this age. But, like, I don't think you can do that from the other side. I think on the other side, you have to get into it as if, you know, you fully know what you want to say right from the word go, as you're saying.
Right. Because I don't think there's a, like, when you stick the flag into the surface of the moon and you're there, I'm still finding it.
Yeah.
There's nothing to say to the things that I've been saying and painting and doing are perfect, or, you know, but there are things that you can say at 20 to really capsulate what it's like to be a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, and then as you grow into yourself, and you have to be honest, you can't just try to catapult yourself into the future and paint like your future self, like at 50, and have it all figured out and have it all together. But I think that you're,
as a 50-year-old, I'm laughing here, but anyway, go on.
You're like, I'm not even doing that at 50. Yeah.
You're obviously not 50 yet.
I mean, and that should be, you know, when I'm lucky enough to have a body of work that spans a couple of decades now. So when I go back and look at my younger work, I was really trying to figure things out. It was so heavy and so, you know, I can now compare it to moments along the way. And I have something to look, like, really compare it to, because there are moments that are a little lighter. There are moments that I was really in a period of just dealing with things, issues in the world and everything else. Yeah. So, you know, my work now hopefully doesn't look like my work did in my 20s.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a good thing about, you know, evolving and really being true and honest. But I would say this is for me. I would say there are technicians and there are artists. Like, an artist is constantly searching for his voice and wants to communicate ideas, you know, to the world. And I think a technician just wants to draw it and make it look like something.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if you would have to tell an artist, no matter the age, you know, find your voice.
Yeah, yeah.
Start. You know, and I think that's the confusing part about so much art on the web and galleries. And I think we just place a stamp on people and say that they're artists. You know, I really do think the artists are born, not made.
Yeah, no, I agree. When you were sort of starting out, you used magazines a lot to really get yourself going. Do you think that magazines are still, you know, vital, or has the internet kind of taken over from that?
I think they're vital. I do. I think that, you know, unless you have Wi-Fi or, you know, internet access and you want to just run your battery down and just be staring at pictures, you can actually take a magazine on the train or, you know, throw a couple of in your bag and just whip them out and just have the access. And
no, I mean from a young artist starting out, the getting into a magazine, is it still as important, do you think, as it was when you were starting out?
Oh, I got you. Not as important, no, because that was kind of like the only show in town,
right?
Back then, I think it's an addendum. I think it's they're still important to this whole artistic community. You know, I think being curated by an editor kind of boost the validity of your work. They're kind of like the gatekeepers to that. I think that's, you shouldn't depend on just getting into a magazine or a feature or winning a contest. I think you should be active every single day doing something that's going to kind of get your name, I don't know where out there is, but out there. Get it out there. I think that's just one part. You know, when I came up, you know, I had such kind of faith in the whole thing. I said, wow, if I could just get one feature. Like, I see these guys in here, they're in here over and over and over, but if I could just get one, you know, people know who I am.
Yeah.
And then I got one, and then I didn't get another one for like 2 years. And I said, this phone's not ringing. What's going on?
Oh, no.
No, I got to rethink this. And then, because a lot of people see me in magazines like every year, a couple of times a year, but that's because of the other stuff that I've been doing. You know, to get the attention of editors and wanting to share what I'm doing with their readers and finding it interesting, and you know, but that's definitely the fuel. You know, the other stuff that you're doing can get you into a magazine, and you know, and it's an international presence, but you have to do it over and over and over. You can't just think that one feature is gonna make you rich.
Yeah. So. Speaking of that kind of businessy side of it, how do you feel about galleries and the current kind of business model? This is a question I've been kind of asking a lot of the artists who are on, because there's the traditional kind of gallery model where the gallery takes a certain amount of the money, or then there's the kind of Ashley Longshore kind of end of things, which is she's just selling directly to her collectors from Instagram and has built up her own contacts and that kind of thing, and then everything in between. Where are you on all of that?
I think that's an individual issue. You know, the person you just mentioned, she might be more savvy than another person that needs that guidance, and a person, a gallery that has access, you know, to a certain collectorship. You know, all artists, there's so many different personalities. Some artists are very reserved, so I would definitely tell them to, at least in the interim, go with the gallery and let them do some of the legwork for you. Myself, I like to do both. I like to have the access to my collectors and certain people that are really passionate about my work. You know, I like to kind of deal with them myself. The galleries can only do so much. And then that whole 50% thing is just, for me, I think, ridiculous.
The amount of money they take.
Yeah. And they don't justify it. Like, if you justified an hourly basis or what you did, they don't have to tell you what they did. They don't have to tell you that a person went to your website, saw that you were collected by this gallery, went to the gallery and bought a piece and just fell into, and you did all the work. They're not going to tell you that.
Right.
So all they have to do is, like the old saying says, if you build it, they'll come.
Yeah.
You know, so you assume that they're doing all this work for you. You assume that they're making calls and, you know, doing some kind of advertising. I don't know, but I like to have both things going on. I don't want to put that much pressure on a gallery to have to just commit to my, because I don't think they could ever meet my expectations of how much time I want them to spend on me. Because now if they can, then they're hired. But I don't think that they want to ignore the other 20 artists they have on their roster and meet my demands, because it would be nothing but phone calls and shaking hands and promotion and, you know, also telling me how wonderful I am a couple of times a day too, you know. So I don't want to put that pressure on someone, because I wouldn't want that pressure put on myself.
Yeah.
So I think with the internet, and also, it's not just the internet, it's the validity now of the internet. I think now artists are seeing it as a more viable and more respectable option to promote themselves, and they don't have to be all savvy and have all the right words. They can actually just do it, you know, in a newsletter or have a website or have an Instagram and do it that way. So I think artists are starting to find out that they can be as good or even better as galleries.
Yeah,
because galleries are using the same social channels, they're using the same trade magazines. They're not doing anything different except for sitting in their gallery. You're sitting in your studio, so I just don't know how far into the future they're going to be able to take it. Unfortunately, because I still do like the brick and mortar kind of thing. I like to still go to openings. Maybe I'm old school, but I like to. It's more like window shopping, you know. Nice. I think that's probably their value is allowing people to actually see the work in person rather than having it on a screen.
Yeah,
and that's unfortunate, but I think that's what they really do bring to the table.
Yeah. Do you like having openings?
I like certain things about having openings. I don't want to sound like a contrarian, but it's a lot of work and it's a huge gamble. You know, you do all this work and you commit it and you can't sell it. And, you know, it's just a frenzy and, you know, you have to worry about framing and everything, and people show up and they could buy everything or they can buy one.
Yeah.
The one that was advertised, you know, so I'm not that much of a risk taker. I live about an hour and a half from Atlantic City, and I've only been there one time. I'm not interested in gambling or anything like that. But the thing that I do like about it is having a cohesive body of work that I've worked on that has that energy that people can actually come and enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, but it's the real world, though. There's always a financial boogie monster lurking in every affair. Everything that you do has to make sense. It has to meet a bottom line. But if it were a moneyless society, I would love openings. Why not?
Well, it goes back to that business model you're talking about, the crazy business model of art galleries, where you're taking all the risk, really. And they're taking is paying the rent, which is very high, I know, but still.
But it's not my fault. You know, you signed a lease before you took me on. You know, you got electric, you have running water.
Yeah.
You know, don't expect me to, you know, be a major part in paying your bills.
Yeah.
You know, and I wish it could just be about the love and the affinity for the artist, but that's where it becomes a little, it can be adversarial, because I talk to a lot of artists, you know. Artists will call me and say, man, I just had a conversation 2 weeks ago about this 50% thing with an artist.
Yeah.
And he just said, I just have to talk to you. And it's like a dark thing, because he was even almost apologetic, like, I don't want to be talking about this, but I can't talk to a lot of people about it.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think about this? Should I talk to my gallery? I said, if you're selling a lot of work for them, yes. If you're not, then no, because you're going to turn them off and they're really not going to promote you. So I feel for them too. You know, they do have to pay their bills, but they don't have a lot of options other than feeding off the artist's hard work to do it.
Yeah. And I've heard some like will take as much as 70%.
Is that legal?
It is if you accept it, I suppose.
It's like slave labor.
Yeah.
How do you feel? How do you feel about it? What are your...
I think it's a crazy model, and it's an old model. It's like there's like lots of things that are, you know, it reminds me of the music industry, you know, 15 years ago kind of thing. It's just, the internet has just changed a lot.
Yeah.
And it's like somebody's going to come up with a way of people being able to physically see the paintings without those overheads, whether that's kind of some kind of cooperative, I know there are kind of artist cooperatives, but something a little bit more organized than that. It's still got the credibility. So I think there's two issues. The credibility, like galleries offer a certain amount of credibility, and then you've got the next level up, which is museums and museum curators. And they are still the gatekeepers to a degree. And then the people who want to buy art will look to them first, kind of go, is this somebody I should buy? kind of
right.
thing.
Right, right, right. So, I saw this morning that Playboy isn't even showing, going to do, after March, they're not even going to do nude images anymore.
Oh.
Yeah, they're going to do like provocative, maybe bikini kind of things. But their point was kind of germane to this conversation we're having. They said people can, you don't
I was wondering
have
how you're going to connect the two there. Just good.
Yeah, I'm going to turn a corner. Just
okay, good. Yeah,
stay with me. No, but people don't have to leave their house. They can have it whenever they want it. Some of these provocative images, they don't have to be embarrassed and go to the counter with this magazine.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so it just doesn't make sense anymore, because they used to sell something like a few billion subscriptions, and now it's like 800,000.
Okay.
So yeah. It just doesn't make sense. People are, the internet has totally killed that too. It's killed music stores.
Hmm.
You know, it's inevitable.
Well, that'll be just the print version of Playboy, because they've pretty much gone online from what I can see.
Yeah.
Everything is online.
I have to trust you, because I haven't gone.
Well,
on
I'm
yet.
Told. Mario, come on.
I have to, if that's what you're saying, I'm just have to trust you.
Damn.
Oh boy. But no, you're totally right. You know, I think it is an old model, and some galleries do a good job. They yeah. do a good job of promoting. They do a good job of being transparent with their artists and working along with their artists.
Yeah.
But some people are just vanity shops, and they just don't have the passion. And I think as the internet makes it more difficult for them, I think they're being kind of squeezed out. So
yeah,
maybe it's a good thing. The cream will rise to the top.
Yeah. No, I think that credibility thing is slowly eroding. I think at that top level of art, you know, collector, I think that's a very trendy, meaning they follow trends. And what's, you know, I think the internet thing is starting to become a trend of like discovering someone on the internet and buying, you know, something. I think that'll probably happen more as well, you know.
It's like more cool.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, a bit of a fad, I suppose. And then it'll yeah. settle down somewhere, like the way the music industry has settled down now to where it's at.
Yeah.
Now, you know?
The gallery thing, as we're talking to it, sounds more and more like the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It really does. You know, yeah. I think just to wrap this up in a nice little bow, I think there's no gallery director around the world that can explain the art better than the person that created it.
Right.
Even if you don't like the person's explanation for it, if you have access, unfettered access to the creator, there's no reason to go through a person. There's no reason why they should have more credibility
yeah.
because they have a...
Yeah. And I think collectors are starting to realize that that's the benefit for them of the internet, that they don't have to actually go through an intermediary, that they can have a personal relationship with the artist, which is something they weren't really able to have before.
Right, or weren't even interested in having. You know, now artists are more savvy, artists are more, you know, they're not looked at as marginalized. They're highly intelligent. So I think now that curtain is being pulled down, there's more of an interest
yeah.
to talk to the artist.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Slightly different thing now. talk about two things I don't really know about that much. One is working with watercolors, and the other thing is surfing. Because my experience of working with watercolor is that it's a bit like surfing. Meaning that there seems to be an element where you just have to accept that it's got its own kind of flow, and you have to surrender to it a bit. Is that right? Is that your experience?
If when it's done right, yes, it should be total surrender. When you try to fight with it and you try to control it, that's when it'll bite you, and it'll come across very static and controlled and just rigid. So I recently went to the Sargent show that they had in New York at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and I was with a lot of oil painters, and they all wanted to go into the little room that they had of watercolors with me to see, like, what are your thoughts? What are you thinking? You know, and they, I was like the Yoda. So they were asking, you know, you think he could have taken, you know, something from his oil painting and, you know, and put it into his watercolor, because it's rare that a person is this good at those two things. And I just shook my head. There's nothing you can take from oil that you can gain by doing a watercolor. They're two totally different things. One with oil allows you to just fix it and noodle and get your thoughts together. And watercolor, the moment that the brush hits the paper, it's a circus. I mean, it's an absolute circus, and everything is happening all at the same time. And I think that's what the problem a lot of my oil painter friends have with it. It's literally like it's like wrangling cats.
Yeah,
it's bizarre.
I'm so relieved to hear you saying that.
yeah. I don't want to come off as, you know, John. No. And that's what makes it fun for me, because I paint in oil as well and pastel. But, you know, even thinking about doing an oil or pastel, you know, it's more meditative, and I like to have fun. So I'll just keep going back to watercolor, not because it's something that I just, you know, have to do. It's fun. It's invigorating. I can't sit down while I'm doing it. It's almost like fencing.
I've seen videos of you working, and fencing is very.
You have to be on your feet. And your mind is, you know, my mind is sharp. It's present. Not that it's not when I'm doing the others, but I know that if I make a mistake, I can spend a few minutes just getting it back on course.
Yeah.
And it's the movement of it is absolutely enchanting. It's beautiful, and it's wonderful. And once you know what you're doing, and I'll put that in air quotes, you'll come up with ways to not take too many risks. Your risk will be more calculated. For instance, if you load up the brush with just an absorbent amount of water, a color mixture, and you put it down, it's going to run everywhere. But if you kind of just put a little bit on, you take it off with the napkin, and then you do it, then you're in the game. Then there's still risk, but you're not just being cocky about it.
You're still on your surfboard.
Right. You're still on your surfboard. Right. You're still on your surfboard. You know, so watercolor is one of those things that you either love it or you hate it. You're not in the middle. I know a lot of people that have tried it one time and they don't want any more of it.
Right. You're an ambassador for Winsor Newton.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Does that mean you get a special car with the flag and everything?
I don't get a Pope Mobile. I don't get the key to the city. I don't get to stay on Fifth Avenue, one of those fancy ambassador residences. But I do have access to the materials, and I get to tell people how wonderful they are without making up stuff. I've used it before I was the ambassador, and they're great materials.
And are you free to use other materials as well? Like Ali Kavanagh was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and she paints on aquaboard. Have you ever tried that or experimented with that kind of thing?
I have not. I had a student that loves Ali, and she brought one of the boards that Ali works on, and she was working. I saw it moving all over the place. It was like glorified hot press. It was just slippery, and that just doesn't fit my taste. And I can't use it anyway, because I have to use Winsor & Newton materials. Okay. I don't have to, but I'm fortunate enough to be able to.
Yeah.
But they also have, you know, other brands under their umbrella. They have Derwent, they have Conte, so I use their drawing materials as well. But I'm old school. I like paper.
Okay.
I like watercolor. I like cold pressed watercolor paper.
Okay.
I don't want to. This is not something where I can start tweaking it and making a faster, you know, surface. And I just, it's like getting a faster sports car. You know, I'd kill myself. This watercolor is hard enough without, you know, throwing stuff into the mix.
Okay. And what are these water soluble oil paints that you've started using? What kind of witchcraft is that?
It's like kabuki theater. It's funny because a lot of people think they're like watercolor, like because I'll glaze them and kind of, you know, work them very thin. But it's water soluble, and for me, I don't like all the fumes and stuff from terps and and other mediums. So you can mix them with water, you can also use medium. They have a water soluble linseed oil and all that kind of stuff. And I know this all sounds like craziness, like oil, water, but you can't tell the difference between the oil and the water soluble oil. You just can't.
So is it the same pigment, just minus the oil?
Mm-hmm.
And replaced with water, if you know what I mean.
Yes, it's the same. It's the same process that they make the oils with. There's just something in there that allows it to interact with water. So they're infusing it with something.
Yeah, because I've seen people grinding their own pigment, you know, the old school, and then adding the oil, and you know, they're making their own oil paint. So I imagine it's a version of that, just using water. Is that right, or have I got that wrong completely?
Yeah, the technology, the chemistry of it, I don't know what exactly is in it to make the oil, because it's kind of like the same milling process,
right.
But whatever they're infusing it with really does allow you to break it down with water.
Okay.
And you cannot tell the difference. A lot of people just hear it, and I think it's polarizing, but if you didn't tell someone, they wouldn't know. I think, like we just talked about with the galleries, you know, the people used to use turpentine in college, and we would all be using it in this one little room, and it's so toxic, like you'd reek of it. It's in your hair follicles, like only knows.
Yeah, so, it's bad for your lungs as well.
Very bad. I can almost feel my nervous system shutting down a lot of times, like if I don't have really good ventilation.
Right.
So this water, even if you have neighbors, if you work at home, and you know, your neighbors don't want to be breathing that in if you're in an apartment, you know.
Yeah.
It's creating a safe work
environment. And is that Winsor & Newton, they're the only ones who are doing that kind of thing? Or is it if other people do
it? No, there are other brands that do it.
Okay.
I just think they do it the best.
Like, whack it on really thick the way you can with oil paint? You know the way some people like to paint that really, you know, palette knifey kind of oil paint? It'll do the same kind of thing, will it?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It feels the exact same. And another great thing is if you want to mix a little bit, if you don't have like the right color, if you run out of a color with your water soluble, say you run out of ivory black, you're like, oh man, and you have regular ivory black, you can mix it. So they're intermixable.
With acrylic?
With regular oil.
Oh, regular oil. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, you just can't put a lot in because it'll clump.
Okay.
But you can also mix it with regular oil.
Okay.
Yep.
So you mentioned your book. Is your book at what level? Is that a beginner book or is it an intermediate, an advanced? Because it's kind of a how-to book, isn't it?
Yes, it's an instructional book. It's kind of like part inspirational, part instructional.
Okay.
It's not one of those like, you know, very basic starter ones where you have all these demos and all this stuff in it.
Yeah.
You know. It's produced by Monticelli Press, who's distributed by Penguin Random House. So they do these beautifully illustrated. They did Juliet Aristides' Lessons in Classical Painting, and so they do these beautifully illustrated books. And there's a little bit of both in there. There's a lot of images in it, and some you know demos. Kind of shows my working process and my palette and things like that.
And are there any videos or anything to go with it, or is it just the standalone book?
It's just the book.
Okay.
Yep, it's just the book.
And when is it out?
The book will be released on April 12, 2016. And it's available now, not that this is a commercial, but it's now available on Penguin Random House for pre-order.
For pre-order.
And it's only $25.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, I'll get a link off you for it, and I'll put it in the show notes so people can link through to it, because I'm sure everyone will want to buy it.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is a question I ask everyone. It's the last question. If there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would it be?
Advice or just in general?
Just in general.
Thing I could pass on. It will probably be, you know, because this world, let's face it, is not the most fair. It's not the fairest playing field. So if there's a person of a different ethnicity, if there's a woman artist, I want people to know that there's at least one, probably many more, but speaking for myself, that got out there and lowered the bar on some of this thinking that only one type of person can do it like this. You know, you have to have a person, a visible person out there to say, hey, what about this kind of person? This kind of person can work on this level and doesn't have to be shtick or karaoke or cartoony. It can be done the right way, and maybe I can do it. So I think that's probably going to be, hopefully, one thing I can take on, pass on to the future. It might not be on a massive level, but maybe one or two people.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Okay, so how can people find you?
They can come to my house if they want. they're not going to get in. But they can find me. My website is Mario, M-A-R-I-O. A as in Apple, Robinson.com. I'm on Instagram, Mario A. Robinson. And I'm on Facebook, Mario A. Robinson Fine Art. Because my personal one is all like filled up and clogged. But if you can get on my artist page, it's Mario A. Robinson Fine Art.
Okay. And will you answer questions for people if they ask you questions in the comments at the bottom of the podcast?
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Mario. I think your work is brilliant, and I think your skill level is brilliant. But you actually turned out to be a really nice person as well.
Oh, thank
which
you.
Which is always a bonus.
Thank you for that shock in your voice. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know why I put it like that, but you know what I mean. It's
you never know.
Yeah, you never know when you, because you can see somebody's work and you can kind of go, oh yeah, I'm sure that they'll be, you know, I've really had a nice time talking to you, and you've actually put some of the points you've made, you put them in a very, very succinct little capsule. So thank you very much for the time, because I know you're super busy.
Great.
And yeah, it's been great talking to you.
Great. And thank you for having me on. I've watched a few of the podcasts, and it's just really good to hear other perspectives and to see how other people approach it and think about it. And, you know, it makes us more connected because, you know, you realize you're not out here alone. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. Okay. So thanks for that again. And we'll talk to you again.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.